I'm Christopher Lydon, peering into the equality gap in America today with the experimental psychologist Dan Ariely of predictably irrational fame. He's made a big career in the zone between what we want and what we choose. When we buy a house, pick a significant other, vote for president. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude. Dan Ariely, we had a thread of conversations going about this 30-year trend to a society of rich and poor in America. Big new wealth at the top, mass debt in the middle and the bottom. And then I read your experiments on this subject, which give new depth to the meaning of predictably irrational. I'd love you to just spell out how you conceived the study and what you found. And then what in the world we do about it?
So the starting point was very simple. Economists often debate about what's the right level of inequality. Right, and you can think about it, if everybody is equal, we have a socialistic country, maybe people have no incentive to work harder, right? That's kind of one theory. And then if we have some inequality, people are motivated to go up the ladder and do more and achieve more and compete with other people. And maybe at some point when it's too large, it demotivates people. But nobody really knows what's the right level. And there's lots of debates about it. So Mike Norton and I decided instead to take a step back and say, rather than coming up with an optimal model from an economic perspective of the ideal wealth inequality, let's ask people what they want, right? Let's ask people what kind of wealth inequality they want. Now, but before we did this, we asked people something else. We first want to know what they think is the wealth inequality in the US, right? So what do people, what people is the perception? So we did a study, you know, so far we've studied about 30,000 Americans in all kinds of samples, but the first study was just kind of a national random sample of Americans. And we said, imagine that there were five segments of people, the bottom 20%, the poorest 20%, the next 20%, the next, and the richest 20%. You say, from the total wealth of 100%, how much wealth do you think is owned by the top 20%, the next, and so on? And basically, I'll ask you, before reading our paper, how much wealth did you think is owned by the bottom 40% of Americans?
I read these numbers all the time, and they're sort of shocking. Bottom 40%, I'd say maybe a lot of them are in debt. Maybe they own 5% of the total.
So on average, people said about 9, but the reality is 0.3.
Net debt in the bottom quintile.
Well, it's basically zero, right? 0.3 wealth. I mean, it's almost nothing, right? Now, this is the bottom 40%. That's a lot. And the top 20% owns 84% of the wealth, right? So this is what economists call the Gini coefficient, the rate of inequality. And the U.S. is very high. We're basically kind of worse than every worse. We have a more skewed distribution at every developed country. And we're close to some countries in Africa and South America that we don't think of ourselves as being part of that. So the first part is we realize people don't understand how much money the rich have, and they particularly don't understand how little the poor have. Okay, then we took the next step and we said, okay, now what do people want? Now, there's lots of ways to ask people, what do you want, right? We decided to take a definition that John Rawls established. John Rawls, the famous philosopher.
Right. What society would you want to wake up in if you didn't know where you were going?
That's right. And the John Rawls' definition was, imagine a society that you knew everything about it. What society would you be willing to enter in the random place? Right? And this idea of random place is very important. He called it the veil of ignorance. Because if you're very wealthy, you might want the wealthy to have money and the poor not to. If you have a very poor, you might want the poor to have money and the rich to have less. But if you don't know where you'll end up, you have to consider all the possibilities. And that's what I loved about Rawls' definition and the veil of ignorance. Consider a society from a step back, which you have to disassociate yourself from your own current level of wealth, because you could be anywhere. You could be among the poorest. You can be among the richest. And we asked people to basically create this wealth distribution. And we found some things that were, you know, hopeful and some that were distressing. First of all, people created a wealth distribution that was much more equal than what we have in the US. In fact, it was more equal than anything in the world right now. In one question, we gave people distributions of wealth. We gave them a distribution of wealth of the US, and we gave them a distribution of wealth that is more equal than Sweden, more equal than Sweden. And we didn't tell them this was the US and this was based in Sweden. We just say, which one would you choose? 92% of Americans chose the one that was based on Sweden, more equal than Sweden. Now, when we show them perfectly equal distribution, socialistic country, nobody wants that, right? So it's not as if people are socialistic, but people have a very different view of the level of inequality we should have. And the view that people have when they take a step back and they think about the Rawlsian constraint, right, they want to create a society that is more equal than anything we have on the planet. Now, that's the distressing thing, right? Because you say, how did we get there? If that's what people really want, how did we get to where we are? And one of the nice things we found was that when we break this question by Republicans and Democrats, we find almost no differences. Men and women, rich and poor. So in our sample, we had all of those. So for example, on the question of would you like to live in a society based on Sweden or based on the US, on average, 92% of Americans prefer the Swedish one. I mean, yeah, it was really quite amazing. You know, Republicans and Democrats want basically the same thing. Rich and poor want basically the same thing. Women and men. Now, there are differences, right? So the 92% that was average for Republican, it was 90.5%, almost 91%. For Democrat, it was 93%. So there are tiny differences, but they're really incredibly small. I'll tell you something else. We repeated this study with NPR listeners and with readers of Forbes magazine, right? And this could be a proxy for lots of things. Almost no difference. Almost no difference. In, when they think in abstract terms about what's the right society we'd want to enter. We also did it at Harvard, and we took people from different departments at the university. And the only slight difference was that the people from Harvard Business School wanted the poor to have slightly less money. but even the Harvard Business School MBAs wanted to create a society that was much more equal than anything we have in the world, right? And much more equal than the US. So now we have this question of how do we reconcile this? We have a society with a very high Gini coefficient, very high wealth inequality. And then when you ask people in an abstract way, they tell you they want something very equal. How do you make the difference? One interpretation is that politicians basically are there to obscure our view of reality. That politicians are basically not allowing us to look or trying to prevent us from looking at society with fresh, distant eyes. And instead, they want us to be pre-committed to some ideology that would obfuscate or obscure our vision. And one way to think about it is think about wine tasting. So when you taste wine, you can have blind tasting, in which you don't know what you're tasting, and you can have non-blind tasting, in which case the label and the price and all of those are going to color your understanding of the wine. I think what politicians do when they give labels to big government and small government and your tax dollars and so on, the moment they give these labels, it's almost like they're labeling the wine. And now that we think about social legislation, we think about social mobility, we don't think about it in terms of equality and what we want, but instead we think about it in terms of these labels that are coloring our view. And people have guttural reaction to words like big government or small government or death panels or whatever it is.
Much less socialism or Sweden too, for that matter.
Yes.
These are striking findings, especially in a campaign year where we have this kind of undercurrent mystery anxiety, but we won't put our fingers on it. I mean, the two big things that I get from what you're saying is, one, we live in a world of illusion about our country. And I, for example, greatly overestimate the stake that poor people have. It's virtually negative, as you say. But secondly, that in our heart of hearts, when we talk to a pollster in vast numbers, we come up with a preference for exactly what Tony Jett was talking about in Ill Fares the Land, a social democracy, a relative equals with a lot of supports and interventions, including taxes, to make it what we want. So many gaps here in the way we live. I mean, how do people feel about living in a house they hate or pretending they love a spouse that they really, you know, doesn't fit the bill? Some lot of cognitive dissonance or something here?
You know, I think part of it is that people don't really recognize where we live. So we have a very segregated society. If you think about it, if you're poor, you don't know how the wealthy live. You might know that Bill Gates... You see it on television, but it's not as if you have a neighbor, right? My guess is that if we lived in mixed neighborhoods, things would have been more annoying for that. But by the way, there's kind of two more pieces of the puzzle I think are worthwhile pointing out. One is this really disturbing research by Bob Frank. Bob Frank has this beautiful book called The Darwin's Economy. And in this book, he said that the real father of economics should be considered Darwin and not Adam Smith. And what he's saying is, he's saying that through economics and the invisible hand and the selfish desire of everyone to better themselves, we can destroy the economy, not improve it, which is the opposite from Adam Smith. And here's the story. So imagine the following. There's an animal called elephant seals. And elephant seals are the kind of an animal that if they get the biggest, they get all the females. Mm. Now, if you're an elephant seal, how big would you want to be? The biggest. There's no returns to being the second biggest, right? You want to be the biggest. Now, the second one gets a few females, but you really want to be the biggest. Mm. So what happened? They all strive to be bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, for each one of them, it's worthwhile trying to get slightly bigger. They are so big these days that they die from heart disease and vascular problems. Mm. And sometimes they even crash their females when they copulate. Not a good society, but they each individually is thriving to be just bigger than the other person. But by each of them thriving to be slightly bigger than the other person, they're destroying the society. Now, of course, you can make the analogy for wanting the biggest house in the neighborhood and taking extra loans for that and so on. And Bob has done that. He's shown that people try to move to neighborhoods that have very good educational system for their kids. Right, a little bit like the elephant seals want to propagate their own. So what they do is they stretch their economic ability. They stretch themselves a little too thin to try and reach to a neighborhood that they really can't afford. And as a consequence, you see divorce, domestic violence, and of course, bankruptcies. Mm. Right? So a little bit like the elephant seals, when we all just worry about our own benefit and we try to be just a little bit better than the other person, we can actually destroy the economy, which I think is the parallel example. And he's saying that the real essence of all this is the education system. Because if you have an education system that is tied to neighborhoods, you're basically getting good education for the wealthy and bad education for the poor. And people have this tremendous incentive to try and take too many loans in order to try and get into the next possible school. So that's one thing that is incredibly important to think about is how is the fight within society to go up not helping us, but actually making us worse off? Hmm. Right, we always think about competition as being good. This is a case where competition is destructive. The second thing is there's a paper by, again, Mike Norton, one of my favorite all-time collaborators, and they looked at the game. They basically put people in a room and they randomly allocated some people lots of money and some people less money and some people very little money. And then they say, hey, would you be willing to allocate some money to the poor from the amount of money you got? Who do you think were the people who were least willing to give money to the poorest?
I don't know. Got to be the poorest.
The second poorest. And they also did this with...
that second quintile.
That's right. They also did this with policies about minimum wage. And it turns out the people who are most against minimum wage who are people who stand to be... who are now the second poorest and would stand to be the poorest. And they call this idea last place aversion. Mm. Where the idea is that the rich are perfectly happy to help the poor. It's the poor, the second poorest, who are not willing to help the most poor. And, you know, you see lots of voting patterns where you say to yourself, these people seem to be voting against their best interest.
Right.
But maybe what they're doing is that they just want to be the poorest. They have such second last place aversion that they're willing to vote in the worst interest of people who are slightly poorer than them, including themselves.
Dan, really, I'm puzzling. You know, if 92% of the voting population in America knew that in their own family, in the country at large, Republicans and Democrats wanted a much more equal society, what in the world would they do about it? And why don't they?
So one thing I think people don't know, but the next experiments we're planning on running are basically experiments that take off from wine tasting, right? And what you do in wine tasting is you show people two wines and you say which one you like better. And then they say this one. And say, hey, surprise, this is the one that cost $8. The one you didn't like so much cost $80. And we're interested in doing the same thing. So we're interested in saying, what if the economic discourse try to get away from cheap rhetorics and try to kind of tap our deep beliefs, right? What if we basically faced a Rawlsian world in the beginning and we said, hey, which world would you like to live in? And then we kind of took off the veil of ignorance and we say, hey, this is Sweden, this is the US. This is the US with the social policy for the poor, and this is the U.S. without a socially policy for the poor. Are you sure? How do you want to vote now? Right. I think when we come with preconceived notions about what Democrats are and what Republicans are, it's very hard to convince us to do anything different because we have our defenses up. Every time, you know, I listen to Rush Limbaugh, I continuously think about all the things he's wrong about, right? The chances that he would ever convince me is very low. Somebody who's a Republican and listen to Obama, probably the same thing happens in their mind. Every word that Obama states, they think about how wrong this is. What if we try to create a world in which we first face our ideology? I think of it like sim politics, right? Have you ever played SimCity?
No.
But you know the game in general?
Yeah.
You know, there's ants, there's people. I mean, you basically create a world. There's all kind of assumptions.
Right.
And what would happen if we ask people to face their assumptions and to create a world that they would want to live in? And then we say, this is what you've just selected. You've just selected the world with these policies and these assumptions and this investment in education and this kind of healthcare system. I think that will be incredibly informative to people to basically face the reality of what their beliefs are really leading to. Because right now we have this disconnect. I believe that nobody in the right mind would choose to create a society that we have right now. If you took something from scratch and you say, please design a society where you think people would be really happy, I can't imagine anybody who would build this society. No, people would be closer and be further, but I don't think anybody would build this one. And now the question is, so if this is the case, how do we get people to recognize it and to realize exactly where we fail?
If your numbers are right, Dan Ariely, why does Mitt Romney not just choose but seem to thrive in the Republican Party on these scare words of socialism and the European way of life?
I think that's exactly the issue, right? He doesn't want to get people to think about what is the right level of inequality. What should we do with the poor? If you ever happen to lose your job for 6 months, how would you like to be treated? I mean, those are the questions we really need to ask ourselves. I think people who are against social policies don't want to ask themselves these questions. Mm-hmm. Instead, they want to create flag words that basically get people rallied up without thinking very deeply about what it is. I mean, what's beautiful about roles is that you really have to think about your deep beliefs. Mm-hmm. What politicians want are not people who think about the deep beliefs. What politicians mm-hmm. want are people that vote with incredible passion. You know, quite a few years ago when I was still in the Media Lab, we had an idea that will change the nature of democracy. And we said, why does everybody have to choose one representative? Why can't you choose one person to vote with your beliefs about education and one person to vote about your beliefs about energy? Why can't you dynamically reallocate your votes to different people? We also said, why can't people decide about how some of the tax money will be reallocated? Why representative democracy makes lots of sense when voting is very tough, but when we have the internet, people can express their opinion all the time. And by the way, I don't have to choose somebody in Congress. Mm-hmm. I can say, I think you understand much more about education. You get my vote for education. And you right. can assign your vote and my vote to somebody else. And we can have like a tree of expertise mm-hmm. where people would basically over time get expertise in their domain and become political leaders. All right. So let's say now we took this to some people in Congress and just talked to them. They were appalled by the idea. They don't want people to vote. Right, I mean, they want people to vote for them, but they don't want really participatory economics. They want trained voters who vote for them, and then they do what's best for them. There's no real desire. I've never seen a real desire in Washington for a new version of democracy that gets people to think deeply about what they want. Just to be fair, and this is not just a Republican, right? It's across the board. Politicians believe that they know best. And what they need to do for the best of the people is just to get elected again.
Throw the people a line here, Dan Ariely. How would the people ever articulate politics of redistribution that you say 90% of us want?
The reality is that fiscal policies are incredibly complex, and what we're willing to spend money on and what are we not willing to spend money on and what a society creates. There's one direction, which is to think about what happens to a society that gets larger and larger income inequality, educational inequality, and health inequality.
These were the Tony Judd questions.
I think we haven't expressed the benefit of those things. So there is the question of just human justice. That's one aspect of it. There's the other question is, how does a country move forward? If I own the factory, I would really want the government to educate my employees. I would really want the government to create roads for them to get there. I would really want the government to spend money on public transportation so my employees could get to their work. I would also want the government to pay for healthcare for my employees rather than myself. Right? I mean, look at what happened with the bailout of the car manufacturers in the U.S. They had something like 19% of their expenses were healthcare.
Yeah.
The Japanese car manufacturer have 5%, right? Because the government is much more efficient than our private healthcare, whatever it is. And therefore, they have an unbelievable competitive advantage. So I think there's a question of kind of what's human rights in terms of what do we think is right. But there's also a question of what's economically viable. And if we live in a society where less and less people are getting educated, and less people are capable, and more and more people are sick, what's going to be the driver of this society? I think it kind of feels to me like the last days of Rome, right? We're celebrating, we're at the top of the income, people are celebrating, things are going very well, there's a lot of wealth, people are accumulating more and more wealth, but it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable to have basically a reduced workforce. And you know what? It also worries me in political terms. We are getting larger and larger numbers of people who don't understand the newspaper, who don't understand policies. And those people are going to vote, right? I mean, we're all together in this, and we're basically creating a situation in which the majority of the people would not have the wisdom to make the decisions that we need to make to move forward. Is this something we want to do? So I think we need to think about, if the U.S. was a business, are we on a sustainable path with this inequality? And then on top of that, we need to think about just human rights. What's right and wrong?
Dan Ariely, I love your eye for the irrational all around us and the way you frame these little tests of it. I want you to cast your eye on the presidential campaign. Unmask that game for us.
Libertarianism has really flourished in the U.S. And I think it's been an incredible movement that has taken a long time to take root. But nobody's saying big government is good, right? Even the Democrats, nobody's saying big government is good. The ideology of libertarianism is, in my mind, so connected now with the American psyche that it's very hard to separate. And it's a really interesting question of how we got there. I'll give you one example.
Yeah, how do you test it, for example?
So I don't know how to test it, aside from telling you that when I meet people in the street and they talk to me about economics, they might have never taken a single class in economics in their lives, but they think like a libertarian. Or these notions of individuals know what they're doing and individuals can figure it out and just small businesses and individual. And that's kind of very much in the, I think, people's idea of what's the spirit of the U.S. and what has made the U.S. successful. And some of it might be correct, but here are kind of two other arguments. One is that every time there's a takeover or a merger between two companies, Wall Street rewards it. And why does Wall Street reward it? Because they believe in economies of scale. What is the biggest economy of scale out there? The U.S. government. I mean, there's no question. I think the reason that Europe is suffering more than we do is that because we have an economy of scale that they don't, that we can do all kinds of things that they don't. If I think about why education institutions in the U.S. are so good, it's because of economies of scale. It's because NSF and NIH. If I think about why research and development are so good in the U.S., it's because the government is creating these infrastructures that are allowing pharmaceuticals and technology companies to do all kinds of things that they cannot do in other places. So there's this argument of economies of scale, which economists deeply believe in. But somehow it doesn't penetrate into the discussion of the role of government. It's only about individualism. The other thing with it, and this is a very different discussion, I always wondered where do we get the idea that if you only leave people alone, they will do the best thing for them? I mean, these are the people who text and drive, right? These are the people who have unprotected sex without condoms. These are the people who overeat and smoke and take recreational drugs. And you know, in some things we understand how stupid people can be, and we have incredible regulation against driving under the influence of alcohol, right? I mean, on one hand, we have these incredible regulations of what you can and can't do with alcohol and drugs. On the other hand, we say, well, but in other areas of your life, you will be perfectly rational and you'll know exactly what to do. I think that, you know, as a researcher, I think that we shouldn't start by assuming that people are perfectly capable and therefore small government let people do what they want. And we shouldn't assume people are incapable. What we should do is be empirical. And we should say, in banking, can people do the right thing? Yes or no? Drinking and driving, yes or no? Education. I mean, we could look at all every aspect and figure out in whether in that aspect people seem to be doing right or wrong. And one more argument about government and private enterprise. I met a guy who has a GPS, one of these companies that make GPSs. And he's an avid Republican, and he talks about how he did it, and how he did it, and he did it, and he did it, which is, and it's really kind of amazing what he did. But of course, the vast majority of investment is the investment of the government. The government put all these satellites in the sky, mostly for military use, and after a while, they basically opened the key and gave him free access to it. And I asked him, how much would be a single GPS device if people had to pay not just for the device you made, but also for the satellites? And he did kind of a back of an envelope calculation. It's a little bit over $10,000. Now, here's a situation where the government did exactly the right thing, which is to invest in very, very expensive infrastructure. No individual company could do that, right? You know, not in this scale. And by the way, Europeans are very worried because Europeans are also using our satellites, and they're worried that one day the US will turn them off. But and what the government did was to invest in tremendous infrastructure and leave the last mile problem to individual enterprise. And I think this is the role of government. But I think this ideology of saying big government is bad, small government is good, without thinking about the role of government, that seems to be incredibly superficial and non-productive. We need a more nuanced version of what we want a successful government to do. And then the size is a very separate issue, right? Because if the government started creating infrastructure, think about rail, electricity. You know, we haven't built any new electrical plants in a long, long time. Somebody has to do it. So we need to have a more nuanced version of what the government needs to do in this modern age.
Is there a way to rebuild government at this late date?
I don't think there's a quick fix. I think in the same way that being libertarians and kind of libertarianism ideology kind of penetrated over 80 years, we need to start creating a new movement, right? And it's not going to be fast.
Really?
It's not going to work out. So it'll be a movement that talked about the ideology of infrastructure investment by the government. It would be an ideology that would talk about relationship between people, right? If you think about all of those aspects, there's the Ayn Rand kind of ideology that says we have one person and that one person deserves to kind of not care about everybody else and do what's good for them, and that will elevate the whole society. You have another ideology that says we're incredibly tied to each other. And I think the economic crisis have shown us, right? Who would have believed that people who borrowed in a subprime mortgage would basically take Wall Street and the whole economy, the world economy, down? We are tied to each other in ways that are much more pronounced now than they ever were. If some poor people decide to stop taking immunizations, lots of other people will suffer from it. We're connected in deeper ways than we were, and I think we need to understand this connection to a higher degree. So that will be one part of the ideology. The other part of the ideology would be about re-envisioning the role of the government. What is it? What can a government that works for the people do? What are the things that we find hard for ourselves to do?
On your scale, how much would we have to change?
In the Bible, it says that after Moses came down from the mountain and he saw the people of Israel celebrating to the golden calf, God basically punished them by getting them to walk in the desert for 40 years, so the generation will die. It might take a generation. I think that might be a reasonable timescale. I think the current generation who is running things might not be the right one. It might be that the generation who is went to college during the financial crisis is the right. Is the right generation.
What, really? And a lot of them are out of work today. What are they learning?
So first of all, I think that they're thinking. They're thinking about what to do. They don't have the, you go to Princeton and you go to investment banking as the path. They think about other things they might do with their lives. And because they don't necessarily have jobs, they follow their passion. My understanding is that volunteerism is up. People are trying all kinds of things. You know, we see an increase in demand for people to go and get graduate degrees. You know, education is always counter-cyclical to the economy. But I think this is a generation that got that, that saw the breakage of some of the ideologies of a kind of perfect capitalism, and they might be the right people to re-envision a new approach. And you know, all of the protests that have been going on around are kind of a really, for me, it's a really positive signal. I grew up in Israel. We demonstrated, I would say, every other week about something. Now, in Israel, there's lots of things to demonstrate about. It's not mostly not economics. It's politics and peace in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. But I grew up in a country that people demonstrate all the time, express their political opinions. And when I came here, I was amazed. There was almost no demonstrations. But now at least there are some demonstrations. Actually, it's really quite amazing to see how much political interest there is to express protest. Now it's not as big, but at least it's kind of a step in the right direction.
What is it besides the politicians, whom the people don't always love or respect, that, that reinforces the ban on class talk or common interests or social democracy? What, you know, the networks, the news magazines, the newspapers, the big ones have to do with it, if anything?
Yeah, so I think discussions are really about social coordination. Right? The things we talk about are the things that we think are okay and safe. Right? Mm-hmm. The reason most small talks are about weather and sports is because we don't want to ask anything extreme. Yeah. So we ask something that is not dangerous. We're not going to offend anybody. It's okay. And I think the media is very much about giving us topics that are safe to talk about. You know, a while ago, I got data from online dating sites, and I got the emails that people corresponded with each other. And I thought this was going to be riveting reading material. It was some of the most boring email I ever read, like where do you go to school and how many brothers and sisters you have. And I was wondering, like, why people write this boring stuff? Are people just interested in that? Is that what they care about? Or they just don't know what to talk about, and because of that, they gravitate to the lowest common denominator. So I did an experiment. And the experiment, there were two people who were in online dating. And we said, today you can't ask anything you want. You can only ask one of these 20 questions. And all the 20 questions were interesting, risque kind of questions. How many people have you slept with? Why did you break from your last relationship? Any STDs, craziness in the family, fetishes, sexual fantasies? Stuff that people really want to know. And what happened was that everybody was happier. Discussion in daily life, the same thing happens. And the question is, what nudges us into a direction of what's acceptable and unacceptable topics to pick? And I think the media is very much in charge of that. So if we both watch Dr. Phil, we have something to talk about. But how comfortable would we be, you and I, to talk about social inequality or racism if that's not something that has been a major topic around us? So I think the media creates kind of acceptable topics to talk about, and then we pick those up and have them as our conversation. Sadly, it's often really uninteresting topics that don't bring people closer together and don't help them figure out anything.
Play editor of the New York Times. I mean, where would you take the conversation in this 2012 election year? Where it seems to me that there's a deep, unsatisfied public yearning, like, if we could only get real, talk about the distress in my family, in my neighborhood, in my state, in my part of the world, in my profession, or anxieties about our kids or whatnot, where would you begin?
So going back to my own research interest, right? So I would start by doing a partnership with Google, and I would start by trying to think about how to present data to people. How do we get people to tell us? I mean, there's the editorial aspect and there is the aggregation, but I would try to get people to tell us what they think, and we would try to tell them based on data what it means for the economy. I would get people to confront the real beliefs. So rather than writing a story about what's the number of women CEOs and men, or what's the number of African-American people in position of power or inequality and so on, I would first ask people to tell me what they think it is. And then I would say, and by the way, and here are the results, right? And I would get people to confront their own understanding. And what was this gap? And what do you think is the gap somewhere else? And then I would ask people, and what do you think would be the consequences of having no welfare or no social security? Or what do you think are the economic consequences? And get people to really reflect on it. Politics is incredibly difficult. We don't know the facts. And because of that, we jump to having cliches and statements. Like if you think about healthcare reform, really hard to figure it out, right? Almost nobody, when you say, would you give up Medicare and Medicaid, say yes. Right. But when you say expand it, people say no also. Why not? What does it mean? Now people have some ideas here and there, but how do we get people to confront the gravity of the situation, what it is that we're really talking about? So maybe what I would do is I would go topic by topic. I would try to understand what people think is the state of the world, and I would confront them with the real state of the world and the implication for that, both socially and economically. And it's kind of a different view of a newspaper, which is not to express the opinion of the people who are writing, but to help people understand their total aggregated view. But I think particularly in an election year, as we come up to this incredibly important decision, it's incredibly important to understand what it is that we're deciding about.
I love your example of telling online dating people what the questions are. And of course, they're the ones that they really wanted to ask anyway. But I also love your invention of these tests. Give us three questions that you'd want people to answer about, you know, their real interest in this election year.
The three questions I would ask is, I would ask them to tell me how many medications, I'm trying to think about simple questions. I would try to ask them to think about how many drugs have been developed over the last 30 years by private industry without any help from NIH, from public's money. And the right answer there is zero. And when you understand, you know, and I would give them all the list of all the drugs that have been developed in the last 30 years, and the drug industry has been really amazing, and to the realization that all of this has happened on top of taxpayers' money, right? It's not as if taxpayers' money developed Viagra, but everything has had a basis in taxpayers' money. So that would be, for me, one question. And after that, I would say, okay, and given that, how much funding should we have for NIH and for healthcare?
Second question
for me would be to do something about education. Again, I think education is not just a moral question. It's a question of, it's a huge barrier for inequality moving forward. And I think what I would ask people is to basically think about how useful would people be in society if 70% or X percent had the third grade reading comprehension and basically no mathematical ability. There's a question that people have in a quiz about math that says, if you had $100 and for 5 years you get 2% interest rate, after 5 years would you have more than $102? You wouldn't believe how many people fail on this question. So I would get people to think about what it would mean to live in a society when the education level is like this. So that would be my second one. And the third one for me would be, again, linked to my own research. I would ask something about conflicts of interest. Conflicts of interest is a huge problem. We have it everywhere. We have it in politics, of course, in a big way with lobbyists, right? That their job is to create conflicts of interest. We have it in banking, of course, where we get people who made tremendous amount of money if their clients make money, and they also make money if their clients lose money, which is not a good system. And we have it in medicine, where a physician can both suggest what test you get and make money from that particular test. And the third thing would be to try and realize the extent of conflicts of interest. So maybe I would ask something like, would you ever agree to go in front of a judge if you knew that this judge was paid 2% of the verdict that they gave you? And I'm guessing everybody would say no. And then I would say, and what do you think about this for politics and for the healthcare system and the financial system, which is basically what we're doing. We're paying people percentage regardless of, you know, what they're doing. That's not an ideal question, but I would try to get people to reflect on conflicts of interest and how bad it is. And the reason this is going to be tough is because people don't see conflicts of interest working on them. Anybody who's a sports fan know that if they go to a sports event and the referee calls a call against their team, they think the referee is evil, blind, stupid, something. But we don't see conflicts of interest working in other areas of life. We don't see that when we go to a doctor and they recommend a particular treatment, that they might be biased because of who exactly is paying them. Or when we go to a banker, they might be biased. So it's a hard one to overcome, but it's really endemic and incredibly devastating in society. So I'd want them to think about that as well.
Dan Ariely, it's such a pleasure. Nothing like you out there sort of waking us up every day. I love your emails that end irrationally yours. We're going to be irrational anyway, probably, but better that we know it. Thank you so much for your work. Thank you for your experiments. Thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure. Always good to see you.
Dan Ariely is professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. His last bestseller was The Upside of Irrationality. Post your comments, please, and your own ideas on the American condition in this campaign year at our website, radioopensource.org. You can follow what we're up to also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.